looking unto Jesus. Started to study on some different areas where we read Jesus involved in things, challenges, testing, temptations, like we looked at in our first point this morning. And then these things would get worse as we noticed, but there are things that we can learn from all of these examples of Jesus. Things that we can learn from how he, what his attitude was, his disposition in dealing with opposition, which he just lived a constant life of opposition. We're going to, in Hebrews chapter 2 and verse 18, one of those several controversial passages in Hebrews is it says, Jesus suffered being tempted. He suffered in connection with the constant challenges that were against him. He suffered on the cross. But this morning we looked at, we looked at some passages on the temptation and noticed things that we can learn from that. Then here's where I ran out of time on the point about Jesus being threatened or challenged, criticized on a higher level. And I want us to take a look at some other things related to that. We started out with 1 Peter 2, where it says, when he was reviled, he did not revile again. He didn't return that upon people. When he suffered, that is, when someone did something to him that we might naturally not be happy with, he did not threaten in retaliation. And so he serves as the perfect example. In Luke 13, we notice that when he was challenged regarding healing on the Sabbath day, and then he cited the example of a man having an ox or a sheep that falls into the ditch, and you get him out. You've worked on the Sabbath day. And they were ashamed with their arguments at that point. A little different. In Matthew 12, how did Jesus handle it when he was accused? They couldn't deny that he was casting out demons. That's pretty obvious because of the changes that took place in the people who were demon-possessed. So it's a hard thing to deny back there in the first century when those things were happening. So what did they do? They charged him with working for the devil. Said, we know what's happening. You're casting out demons by Beelzebub, the ruler of the demons. Verse 24. And we see the logic of the mind of God here. Jesus knew their thoughts. Now, that's one of several times in the New Testament where it says that Jesus knew their thoughts. He knew their motivations. He knew what they were up to here. He said, every kingdom divided against itself is brought to desolation. Every city or house divided against itself will not stand. And if Satan cast out Satan, he is divided against himself. How then will his kingdom stand? Now, is that not logical? We think in terms of just a practical knowledge and understanding how things work. How you might propagate a thing. If you want people to believe a message, then can you be that self-contradictory and convince other people to follow what you're saying? You cannot. This is true in any area. It's true in politics. It's true in religion. And then what about this accusation of casting out demons by Beelzebub? Well, he said, and this is what we call an ad hominem argument. That's an argument that's made to the person, or they say, to the man. It's made to the person. In other words, it's based upon inconsistency. Points out inconsistency. If Satan, he said in verse 27, if I cast out demons by Beelzebub, by whom do your sons cast them out? Therefore, they shall be your judges. In other words, the Jews believed that they had people who could do this. You know, you read about this later in the book of Acts, who could cast out demons. They believed that's what they were doing. And Jesus used that. He used their argument, their belief that they could do this, and said, now, if I cast out demons by the prince of the demons, then who, by whose authority, whose power do your sons cast them out? And he said, therefore, they shall be your judges. It's okay to use this type of retort, of this type of response to people. But if I cast out demons by the Spirit of God, surely the kingdom of God has come unto you. That's his point. Sometimes Jesus did something like that. Look at John chapter 7 and verse 20. John 7, several of these revolve around something that the Jews believed that had become quite a misconception to them about the Sabbath. And here's another one in John chapter 7 and verse 20. They answered and said to him, you have a demon. Who is seeking to kill you? What are they talking about here? Jesus had just asked in verse 19, why do you seek to kill me? Who is seeking to kill you? This is on their part, dishonesty. It's an absolute denial of the recent history of dealings with Jesus. All you have to do on that is go back. We're not finished with John 7, but all you have to do, if you want the history of that, is you go back to John chapter 5 and verse 16. It says, for this reason the Jews persecuted Jesus and sought to kill him. Now, when Jesus referenced this reality, this fact, that people in the very recent past had tried to kill him, they said, what are you talking about? People are trying to kill me. You have a demon. You must be demon-possessed yourself. What does the rest of verse 16 say? They sought to kill him because he had done these things on the Sabbath. Now, it gets worse, and so they're even more wrong in John 7. My father, he didn't say our father, my father has been working until now, and I have been working. And what that verse means is that when the Father worked, Christ worked. When Christ worked, the Father was working. So he's claiming a perfect unity with the Father. Then on top of that, he called God not our Father. You know, they didn't try to kill him in Matthew 6 when he said, here's how you pray, our Father who art in heaven. But when Jesus said, my Father, he's claiming a special relationship with the Father, something different than normal people sustain with the Father. So when he said that, the Jews, verse 18, sought all the more to kill him. So they didn't just want to kill him. They wanted all the more to kill him. They're really animated by the time of John chapter 5 and verse 17. So it seems rather, and it is, hypocritical of them to say in John 7, you have a demon, no one seeking to kill you. That is a denial of reality. But even so, what did Jesus do? How did he answer that? He said, I did one work, and you all marvel. What was that? That's referring to John 5 earlier, where he healed the lame man. Moses therefore gave you circumcision, not because it is from Moses, but from the fathers. I always thought it was kind of funny. That's just historically and technically accurate. It was given to Abraham. It was given to Abraham, not to Moses, not through the law of Moses. But he said, not because it was from Moses, but because it was from the fathers. And you circumcise a man on the Sabbath. Why might they circumcise a baby on the Sabbath? Well, if the 8 days from birth ended up being a Sabbath day, they strictly followed the law of Moses. Jesus said, that's what you do. If a man receives circumcision on the Sabbath so that the law of Moses should not be broken, that is, that you don't do it on the seventh day or the ninth day, but that you do it as the law stipulated on the eighth day, he said, are you angry with me because I made a man completely well on the Sabbath? So, here's a medical procedure that was done for male Jews at 8 days. It was a partial thing, it was a small thing, but God required it. Jesus says, I did a procedure that made someone completely whole. made someone completely well. Why are you judging me? And those verses come right before one that we use a lot in verse 24 of John 7. It goes with Matthew 7, 1 through 5, judge not that you be not judged, where Jesus cautions against unjust judging, hypocritical judgment. And so John 7, 24 says, do not judge according to appearance, but judge with righteous judgment. You should think before you make arguments like this, but this was reasonable. But there's something else that we can do in following the example of Jesus. Rather than beat ourselves up and feel discouraged, do what Jesus did. Sometimes it's as simple as this. Here's how easy a thing could be answered. In John chapter 8, verse 48, it says, then the Jews answered and said to him, do we not say rightly that you're a Samaritan and have a demon? You're a Samaritan and have a demon. That's the accusation. How did Jesus answer this one? Didn't take long. He said, I do not have a demon. He just denied the charge. And sometimes that's the best way. So we can learn from Jesus when he was opposed, when he was challenged, in different methods, depending upon the circumstance, depending upon the people, sometimes we may have to make determinations there. But Jesus teaches us exactly what we can do. What about if we didn't have anything, or what we did have, we lost? You know, people lose a lot of things in life. They lose things they had. Maybe some people just never had much. But a lot of people acquire things, and maybe a tornado comes through, a hurricane, the flooding that we saw last year. Things like this can happen, and people lose everything that they have. What do we learn from Jesus about this? We talked about in Matthew chapter 8 what he owned, what he had. Remember what all Jesus, the long list in Matthew chapter 8 of earthly possessions of Jesus. That's why Matthew 8 is so long. It's because Jesus had to go down this long list of everything he had. Now, that's not what we read. We read in verse 19, that a scribe came and said to him in verse 19, Master, I will follow you wherever you go. Jesus wanted to make sure the man understood what he was in for if he does this. He said to him, the foxes have holes, the birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man hath not where to lay his head. He didn't even have his own house. He didn't own a house. He didn't own property. He said in Luke chapter 12, of course, leading up to the story of the rich man, the rich farmer, I should be more precise on that, the rich farmer. And he's going to tell what was wrong with the man as far as his attitude towards his possessions. Remember, that's the man that he had good farming year, and so he said, what can I do with all of the goods that I've obtained? I'll tear down my barns. I'll build bigger barns. That's the solution to this. But what he didn't take into consideration is what we read in Luke chapter 12 and verse 20, where God intervenes and says, you fool, this night your soul will be required of you. Then who shall these things be which you have provided? Who is the rich person, Jesus? Well, he who lays up treasure for himself and is not rich towards God is not laying up treasure in the right place. We'll read that in Matthew chapter 10. But back in verse 15, he said, take heed and beware of covetousness, for a man's life consisteth not in the abundance of the things that he possesses. We'll read that here in Luke chapter 12. In verse 22 of this same chapter is where that is. Jesus said, therefore I say unto you, take no thought for your life, what you shall eat, neither what you shall for your body, what you shall put on. For the life is more than meat, the body is more than raiment or clothing. Consider the ravens, for they neither sow nor reap, which neither have storehouses nor barn, but God feeds them. How much more are you better than the fowls? So Jesus teaches the lesson about true treasure, real value. And on top of that, as we studied in class this morning with the Hebrews 1 passage that talks about in verses 10 through 12, the folding up of the garment of the universe as it becomes worn, useless. And the Hebrew writer said, now that's how it's going to be in the end. Jesus will fold it up. But in 2 Peter chapter 3, the elements will melt with fervent heat. The earth also and the works in it shall be burned up. So we need to remember this. This helps us to create a balance and keep a proper and safe attitude towards the world, the purpose of the world or the things of the world. We need to remember that sooner or later it's all going to be gone. You know that's true when you think about your life or things that you have bought or acquired, and then you look at how little of it you actually use every day. That's a good measure of that. That's just the way it is in this life. So we need to be very careful to maintain a proper perspective. What about when we are persecuted? What did Isaac read in Matthew chapter 10? Does Jesus help us here? When he was threatened, and when he suffered, he threatened not. He did not think in terms of retaliation. And in Matthew chapter 10, what we actually read is that disciples are to be like their master. Christ is our master in every regard, all aspects of our lives. And so we want to think in terms of, how can I model Christ? How can I follow Christ? Well, he warned. Now, these verses are on the heels of instructions that he gave here to the preachers in the limited commission. And he told them, take no thought how or what you shall speak, verse 19. For it shall be given you in that same hour what you shall speak. For it is not ye that speak, but the Spirit of your Father who speaks in you. And what's going to happen as a result of this teaching, even though this is miraculously provided? They were guided. The point of this passage is a great revelation passage. The point of those two verses is that you will not have to, as Luke's account says, premeditate upon what you're going to say. Incidentally, that's not with the cessation of the miraculous work of the Holy Spirit, 1 Corinthians 13, 8 through 10. We do. We'd better premeditate today, or we'll stand up before people presuming to speak on behalf of God and speak things that are not on behalf of God. We'll say things just off the top of our head. We're not guided by Scripture. If we're not guided by Scripture, we can't speak as the oracles of God. So that part is different. We must today premeditate upon what we will say. But why is this important? Why verses 19 and 20 and all of a sudden verse 21? Because he switches to the consequences of this teaching. What are the consequences? He says, brother shall deliver up brother to death. That's pretty strong. Notice first the relationship. And he's going to talk about family with several relationships inside family. Excuse me, in verse 34 of this same chapter, just a few verses later, he's going to talk about family again. So brother, and some of us can't imagine this. Yeah, I can't imagine doing one of my physical brothers this way or them doing it to me. But he goes on. He said, father the child. That's hard to imagine, though there have been stories of this happening. Father the child. Children shall rise up against their parents and cause them to be, what, to go to jail? To be looked down upon, be ridiculed. Cause them to be put to death. That's how severe it would become. And so that's verse 21 of Matthew chapter 10. How bad will it be as a result of this teaching? And by the way, all this is an applied standard. I think I make that point. All this is the applying of a standard that people don't want. That's how far it goes. You'll have a father delivering up a child to death, or parents delivering up their children delivering up their parents to death, all because they don't like the standard. He said in verse 22, "You'll be hated of all men for my name's sake, but he that endureth to the end shall be saved." My next point, we're going to talk about that and emphasize that as a part of the overall example of Christ. And when we look to Christ, what we can gain in some of these areas. He said, "He who endures to the end shall be saved. But when they persecute you in this city, flee to another one." Now, what does that say about the disposition of the persecuted ones? He didn't say when they persecute you, retaliate. Persecution, religious persecution, is not a basis, a just basis for physical retaliation. That's not when we, you know, open up the gun safe, get out the ARs. That's not reason for that. We talked about that this morning when it comes to physical protection. What about persecution? Persecution involves taking a stand for God, on God's behalf, in His name. We're not going to stop doing that. So persecution just means escape persecution. "When they persecute you in this city, flee to another. For verily I say unto you, you shall not have gone over the cities of Israel till the Son of Man comes." Now keep in mind, there are multiple comings of Christ. I have a sermon where I go through four different comings of Christ. You have one that's going to be the final coming of Christ. But in Matthew 24 and in Luke 21, one was predicted where Jesus would come, but it was coming in judgment of Israel in 70 AD when the armies of the Gentiles surrounded Jerusalem. Luke 21, verse 20. So that was very specific there. And in that context, it said that people would see Him come. Jesus would come in some capacity, in some way. It's all kinds of speculation about how Christ came in that judgment. But He did come. He did come. And that's what this is talking about. He said, you will not have gone over the cities of Israel until the Son of Man, because it happened in 70 A.D. "The disciple is not above his master, nor the servant above his Lord." Why did He say that in this context? Because if they persecuted the master, they're going to persecute the disciple as well. And later in this chapter in Matthew 10, He talks again about family. And He needs them to understand that verse 34, He said, "I did not come to bring peace upon the earth, but rather a sword." Teaching is divisive. We have to brace ourselves for that. It's just reality. Truth is divisive. People who are affected by it can be, when they agree upon it and accept it, be drawn very firmly together. When people reject it, they can get very angry. And they can sometimes be very dangerous. "I'm come to set a man at variance." And this is that passage. Verse 35. "Against his father, daughter against the mother, daughter-in-law against..." See, these are other family relationships. "A man's foes or enemies shall be they of his own household." In John 15, let's look over there and wrap up this point. John 15, Jesus talks about persecution and how it's related to two different standards. On the one hand, you have what He calls the world. The world. Really what that means here in this passage, John 8:15-18, is the world standard. Because He said, "If the world hates you, you know that it hated Me before it hated you. If you were of the world would love its own. Yet because you're not of the world, but I've chosen you out of the world, therefore the world hates you." When He says, "I've chosen you out of the world," that's because of the calling of the gospel. Chosen by the gospel. Remember the word that I said to you, a servant is not greater than his master. If they persecuted me, they will also persecute you. If they kept my word, they will keep yours also. So whatever we learn here from Jesus and about Jesus, be ready, that fits us as well. That's his argument right here. And in subsequent verses, actually all the way down through chapter 16, where we talked about recently, that's the passage that says that the time will come when a man who they will cast you out of their synagogues, and a person will claim that he's doing God a service by killing you. Well, they killed Jesus, and they thought they were doing God a service. Paul, while he was still Saul, was arresting Christians that were ultimately, many of them, put to death. He thought he was doing God a service. So that's how far that can go. So when we're persecuted or rejected, we need to remember Jesus, and we need to remember the words of Jesus in Matthew 5, verses 10 through 12, the rejoicing passage. When we're persecuted, we need to see that actually in a positive way. This means that we are identifying with Christ, with God, but also he talks about the prophets there. He said, for so persecuted they the prophets that were before you. The disciples in Acts chapter 5 and verse 41 departed from the presence of the council where they had been beaten and commanded not to preach anymore in the name of Jesus. They departed from the presence of the council rejoicing that they were counted worthy to suffer shame for his name. We need to rejoice. Let's look at one other area here. When it comes to service to God, we might use any different number of Bible expressions for this. For example, the expression, please God. We are to know how we ought, Paul said, to walk and to please God. But I think all of it could be summarized under the term serve. To serve God. What things are involved in this? What can we learn from Jesus? We ought to look unto Jesus for things like this. What about the old practice? It's pretty common. People easily fall into this. I see how it's so attractive. Of religion of convenience. Too many people practice that religion. Too many people in the world. Too many who call themselves Christians, and of course, a great number of people who perceive themselves to be Christians who are not, obviously do this. They just serve God when and where they want to. Very sporadic. There's nothing disciplined about it. And I think that's the part that makes it hard. Remember our word discipline and the Bible word disciple. Being a disciple is a discipline. It's a discipline. It's a life of discipline. And we're compared in 2 Timothy 2 to being soldiers. Paul did that. 2 Timothy 2. So, what do we learn from Jesus about this? Well, John chapter 8 and verse 29. What did he say about the nature of his service? Was it just when it was convenient for him? Just when he felt like it, just when he wanted to, maybe he kind of had a schedule he kept. I've known Christians before, it almost seemed like this was how they measured faithfulness. It's almost like you could look at a calendar and maybe pick out certain months, maybe a certain frequency of it. I'm telling you, I've known brethren like this before. It seemed like it worked on some kind of frequency where it'd be like a month or two on and a month or two off. Is that Jesus? He said, I always do those things that please my Father. So what was his frequency? Always. That's what you call a life of faithfulness. That's what you call doing the will of God. In Well, let's look at passages I have here in order in Luke chapter 9 and verse 23. Notice what is involved in this. Not my will. In order for me to be able to accomplish this, this has to become a discipline. It can't be my will. Otherwise, there are going to be things come up and I will reason, I will use human reasoning, and I'll mess around and justify myself by reasoning, I've done enough on that. I've attended services pretty good for a while. I'm entitled here to miss some services and just do what I want to do. We need to be careful about this mentality. Jesus said, I always do the will of God. He's the model. And in Luke 9, in verse 23, Jesus said, if any man will come after me, let him deny himself, take up his cross as frequently as he chooses, with whatever regularity he chooses. No. Take up his cross daily and follow me. What's involved in serving God? Well, that's these passages teach. Paul over in Philippians chapter 3, that's a chapter where Paul goes through and he talks about, if we were to measure ourselves based upon our earlier religious accomplishments, for example, in the religion of Judaism, Paul says, if I were to do that, then here's my resume. Paul could actually say, here's my resume and let me see yours and let's compare them and see who's wins. He could have done that. And he would have won. He would have won every time. But what was his mentality? He wanted to be found. He considered those things as rubbish, verse 8, latter part, chapter 3 of Philippians. He says, I want to be found in him not having my own righteousness. I wonder how many times we remember that when we start sort of fabricating our own definition of what it means to be a disciple, whatever our discipline is going to be, that's actually fabricating our own standard of righteousness. We need to be careful about that. Romans chapter 10 and verse 3, Paul said his Jewish relatives, they had a zeal for God, but not according to knowledge. He said they're going about to establish their own righteousness. We need to be careful about that. We need to always do the will of God. There's another aspect of this in John. Oh, I see where I got myself off track here. I didn't mention John 3 and verse 4. John 4 and verse 34 at the beginning of this point. Jesus in John 4:34 said, my meat, my sustenance, my food is to do the will of him who sent me and finish the work. So there are two things to that point I just covered. God's will, to do his will and finish the work. Would help if I would include all the passages that are in my head. But I did include it in the last point. The other thing is to finish the work. Do we think about that? I worry sometimes that maybe Christians, as they get older, start to maybe think in terms of, I've done that a long time, I should be okay. No, we need to continue to work. We need to continue to apply ourselves, to remember to be faithful, because we want to finish the work. Wouldn't it just be tragic for someone to endure persecution, to forego maybe certain luxuries in life and opportunities in life, people do, in the name of Christ. Maybe certain jobs that would have made you a lot more money if you weren't so restricted, limited by commitment to God. People do this stuff. They make these choices. People make those wrong choices all the time, every day. What about that? But no, they forego those things and then get to the end and compromise. Or get to the end and give up. This is very dangerous. Jesus said, now my purpose is to do God's will, to finish the work. when I read that, it reminds me of the passage in Revelation chapter 2 and verse 10. Revelation 2 and verse 10, one of those only two churches of the seven in Asia to whom John wrote in Revelation chapters 2 and 3, only one of the two, the other was Philadelphia, had no sins against it. But in verse 10, the church at Smyrna was told, fear none of those things which you shall suffer. He said, behold, the devil shall cast some of you into prison that you may be tried. You will have tribulation 10 days. That is, it will be thorough. 10. One of the complete numbers, one of the whole numbers in the book of Revelation. Like the numbers 3, 4, and 7, and 12. 3, 4, 7, 10, and 12. Well, here's a 10. You'll have tribulation 10 days. Be thou faithful unto death, and I will give thee a crown of life. There's just an absolute promise of salvation based upon what condition? That we finish the work, that we stay committed as long as we're breathing, long as we have the ability to do so. We need to stay faithful. So, rather than become discouraged, we can just always look to Jesus. Some of the passages that we looked at remind us that our faithfulness may include doing some very simple things. Very simple things. I always think that when I think of that passage in John 8:48, and Jesus there, when they said, You're a Samaritan and you have a devil. He said, I don't have a devil. That's a simple thing. We can mimic Jesus in all of these areas and conduct ourselves in a way that will be right. And have the hope of that crown. He said, I'll give it to you. I'll give you the crown of life. Maybe there's someone here this evening who's not a child of God. We want to offer you that opportunity to simply do what Jesus invited all to do. Come unto me, all you that labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Get that invitation early on in the book of Matthew, and in it, right there at the end of the Bible in Revelation chapter 22, you see it again in verse 17. The Spirit and the bride say, come. And he goes on, let him that is thirsty come, and whosoever will, let him come and take the water of life freely. If you want to do that, we're happy to help you. If you need to put on Christ in baptism, we're happy to help you do that tonight. If you've sinned and you are a child of God already, but you've sinned in a way that you've brought reproach back upon the Lord's body, and you want to take care of that publicly, we'll be happy to pray with you and pray for you. If you're subject to the invitation, come forward as we stand and sing to encourage you.